This is Audible.
Victory Bell Audio presents The Complete Guide to Fasting. Heal Your Body Through Intermittent, Alternate Day, and Extended Fasting by Jason Fung, MD, with Jimmy Moore, narrated by Jimmy Moore. The information included in this book is for educational purposes only. It is not intended or implied to be a substitute for professional medical advice. The reader should always consult his or her healthcare provider to determine the appropriateness of the information for his or her own situation, or if he or she has any questions regarding a medical condition or treatment plan. Listening to the information in this book does not create a physician-patient relationship. To the listener of this audiobook, please note that portions of the content from the print version of The Complete Guide to Fasting are available in the form of a complimentary PDF downloadable from audible.com or the iTunes library. These include sample fasting plans, recipes, visual material such as graphs and charts, testimonials, and bibliographic references. If you purchased this audiobook on iTunes, the PDF may appear in your music library rather than your book library. Should you run into any issues accessing these materials, please contact Victory Belt Publishing at victorybelt.com to request the PDF. Introduction by Jason Fung, MD. I grew up in Toronto, Canada, and studied biochemistry at the University of Toronto, where I also completed medical school and my residency in internal medicine. After my residency, I chose to study nephrology, kidney disease, at the University of California, Los Angeles, mostly at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center and West Los Angeles VA Medical Centers, then known as the VA Wadsworth. Each field of internal medicine draws its own personalities, and nephrology has the reputation of being a thinker's specialty. Kidney disease involves intricate fluid and electrolyte problems, and I enjoy these puzzles. In 2001, I returned to Toronto to start my career as a nephrologist. Type 2 diabetes is far and away the leading cause of kidney disease, and I treat many hundreds of patients with this disease. Most type 2 diabetics also suffer from obesity. By the early 2010s, my interest in puzzles combined with my professional focus on obesity and type 2 diabetes had led me to focus on diet and nutrition. How did I go from preaching conventional medicine to prescribing intensive dietary strategies, including fasting? Despite what you might think, nutrition is not a topic covered extensively in medical school. Most schools, including the University of Toronto, spend a bare minimum of time teaching nutrition. There were perhaps a handful of lectures on nutrition in my first year of medical school, and virtually no teaching on nutrition throughout the rest of medical school, internship, residency, and fellowship. Out of the 9 years spent in formal medical education, I would estimate I had 4 hours of lectures on nutrition. As a result, I had no more than a passing interest in nutrition until the mid-2000s. At the time, the Atkins diet promoting low-carb eating was in full swing. It was everywhere. Some family members of mine tried it and were ecstatic with the results. However, like most conventionally trained physicians, I believe their arteries would eventually pay the price. I, along with thousands of other physicians, had been taught and certainly believed that low-carbohydrate diets were simply a fad and the low-fat diet would prove to be the best. Then studies on the low-carb diet started to appear in the most prestigious medical journal in the world, the New England Journal of Medicine. Randomized controlled trials compared the Atkins diet to the standard low-fat diet that most healthcare providers recommended. These studies all came to the same startling conclusion. The low-carb diet was significantly better for weight loss than the low-fat diet. Even more stunning was that all the important risk factors for cardiovascular disease, including cholesterol, blood sugar level, and blood pressure, were also much improved on the low-carb diet. This was a puzzle, a real conundrum, and that was where my journey began. Figuring out what causes obesity. The new studies proved that the low-carb approach was a viable one. But this didn't make any sense to me because I was still steeped in the conventional calories in, calories out approach. The idea that the only way to lose weight is to consume fewer calories than you expend. Diets based on the Atkins methodology, for example, did not necessarily restrict caloric intake, yet people were still losing weight. Something didn't add up. One possibility was that the new studies were wrong. However, that was unlikely given that multiple studies all showed the same result. Furthermore, they confirmed the clinical experience of thousands of patients who were all reporting weight loss on the Atkins diet. Logically, accepting that the studies were correct meant the calories in, calories out approach had to be wrong. Much as I tried to deny it, there was no saving the calories in, calories out hypothesis. It was dead wrong. And if the calories in, calories out hypothesis was wrong, then what was right? What caused weight gain? What was the etiology, the underlying cause of obesity? Doctors spend almost no time thinking about this question. Why? Because we think we already know the answer. We think that excessive caloric intake causes obesity, and if eating too many calories is the problem, then the solution is eating fewer calories and burning more through an increase in activity. This is the eat less, move more approach. But there's an obvious problem. Eat less, move more has been done to death over the past 50 years, and it doesn't work. For all practical purposes, it doesn't really matter why it doesn't work, although we'll look into that in Chapter 5. The bottom line is that we've all done it, and it doesn't work. The underlying cause of obesity turns out to be a hormonal rather than a caloric imbalance. Insulin is a fat storage hormone. When we eat, insulin increases, signaling our body to store some of this food energy as fat for later use. It's a natural and essential process that has helped humans survive famine for thousands of years, but excessively and persistently high insulin levels result inexorably in obesity. Understanding this leads naturally to a solution. If excess insulin is causing obesity, then clearly the answer lies in reducing insulin. Both the ketogenic diet, a low-carb, moderate-protein, high-fat diet, and intermittent fasting are excellent methods of reducing high insulin levels. Insulin and type 2 diabetes. However, in my work with type 2 diabetics, I realized that there was an inconsistency between the treatment of obesity and the treatment of type 2 diabetes, two problems that are closely linked. Reducing insulin may be effective in reducing obesity, but doctors like me were prescribing insulin as a cure-all treatment for diabetes, both types 1 and 2. Insulin certainly lowers blood sugars, but just as surely, it causes weight gain. I finally realized that the answer was really quite simple. We were treating the wrong thing. Type 1 diabetes is an entirely different problem than type 2. In type 1 diabetes, the body's own immune system destroys the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. The resulting low insulin level leads to high blood sugar. Therefore, since insulin levels are low to begin with, it makes sense to treat the problem with supplemental insulin, and sure enough, it works. In type 2 diabetes, however, insulin levels are not low but high. Blood sugar is elevated not because the body can't make insulin, but because it's become resistant to insulin. It doesn't let insulin do its job. By prescribing more insulin to treat type 2 diabetes, we were not treating the underlying cause of high blood sugar, insulin resistance. That's why, over time, patients saw their type 2 diabetes get worse and required higher and higher doses of medications. But what caused the high insulin resistance in the first place? This was the real question. After all, we didn't stand a chance of treating the underlying disease if we didn't know what caused it. As it turns out, insulin causes insulin resistance. The body responds to excessively high levels of any substance by developing resistance to it. If you drink excessive alcohol, the body will develop resistance up to a point. We call this tolerance. If you take narcotics such as heroin, your body will develop resistance. If you use prescription sleep medications such as benzodiazepines, your body will develop resistance. The same holds true for insulin. Excessive insulin causes obesity, and excessive insulin causes insulin resistance, which is the disease known as type 2 diabetes. With that understanding, the problem with how doctors treat type 2 diabetes became clear. We were prescribing insulin to treat it when excessive insulin was the problem in the first place. Instinctively, most patients knew what we were doing was wrong. They would say to me, "Doctor, you have always told me that weight loss is critical in the treatment of type 2 diabetes, yet you have prescribed me insulin, which has made me gain so much weight. How is that good for me?" I never had a good answer for them. Now I knew why. They were absolutely right. It wasn't good for them. As patients took insulin, they gained weight, and when they did, their type 2 diabetes got worse, demanding more insulin, and the cycle repeated. They took more insulin, they gained more weight, and as they gained more weight, they needed more insulin. It was a classic vicious cycle. We doctors had been treating type 2 diabetes exactly wrong. With the proper treatment, it is a curable disease. Type 2 diabetes, like obesity, is a disease of too much insulin. The treatment is to lower insulin, not raise it. We were making things worse. We were fighting the fire with gasoline. I needed to help my obesity and type 2 diabetes patients lower their insulin levels, but what was the best approach? Certainly, there are no medications that do this. There are surgical options that help, such as bariatric surgery, commonly called stomach stapling, but they are highly invasive and have many irreversible side effects. The only feasible treatment left was dietary, reducing insulin levels by changing eating habits. In 2012, I established the Intensive Dietary Management Program, which has a unique focus on diet as a treatment for the twin problems of obesity and type 2 diabetes. At first, I prescribed low and very low carbohydrate diets. Since refined carbohydrates highly stimulate insulin, reducing these carbohydrates should be an effective method of lowering insulin. I gave my patients lengthy sessions of dietary advice. I reviewed their food diaries. I begged, I pleaded, I cajoled, but the diets just didn't work. The advice seemed hard to follow. My patients had busy lives, and changing their dietary habits was difficult, especially since much of it ran contrary to the standard advice to eat low fat and low calorie. But I couldn't just give up on them. Their health, and indeed their very lives, depended upon reducing their insulin levels. If they had trouble avoiding certain foods, then why not make it as simple as possible? They could simply eat nothing at all. The solution was, in a word, fasting. Not Just Another F Word, My Experiments with Fasting, by Jimmy Moore. In the coming pages, you will read all about the therapeutic uses of fasting and how to implement it in your own life in order to experience its amazing health benefits. But you might be wondering what the experience of fasting actually looks like, perhaps particularly from someone who was extremely skeptical about fasting until he tried it for himself. That's precisely what I'll be sharing with you in this chapter. My name is Jimmy Moore, and I'm the internationally best-selling author of the ketogenic cookbook, Keto Clarity and Cholesterol Clarity, as well as the host of the longest-running health podcast, The Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore. When I discovered Dr. Jason Fung's incredible work on fasting, I knew we needed to collaborate to get comprehensive information about fasting into the hands of as many people as possible. But I wasn't always such an exuberant fan of fasting. This has got to be a joke, right? When I first heard about fasting as part of improving your overall health over a decade ago, it might as well have been described as the other F word. Why in the world would you purposely starve yourself? How could anyone possibly think that deliberately being hungry would ever be a good thing? This has got to be a joke, right? Believe me, I know many of you listening to this audiobook have had some of these exact same thoughts. And back in 2006, I didn't fully comprehend the positive benefits fasting would someday provide me, including its amazing effects on my cholesterol and blood sugar. I first heard about the concept of intermittent fasting from Dr. Michael Eads, author of the best-selling book, Protein Power. In 2006, Dr. Eads began writing about the great success with weight loss and other health benefits he had seen with something called intermittent fasting, or IF. It was a new idea at the time to go periods of time without eating anything at all on a regular basis, and the way he described it seemed relatively doable. Stop eating at 6 p.m. and then don't eat again until 6 p.m. the next day. So you still got to eat every single day, but this strategy forced your body to go without food for 24 hours at a time. I have to admit, I had never gone that long without eating in my entire life, and I was extremely skeptical about the whole idea of fasting, even on an intermittent basis. Why? Because I like to eat, as evidenced by the fact that I once weighed in at a whopping 410 pounds. Of course, at that weight, I was consuming lots of processed junk food and sugary sodas like there was no tomorrow. Growing up in college, when I got married in my 20s and into my early 30s, I had terrible eating habits that contributed to some pretty significant metabolic damage. Thankfully, in 2004, I came across information about the low-carb diet, which enabled me to lose 180 pounds in 1 year and come off of 3 prescription medications for high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and breathing problems. I had to share about the incredible health success I'd found on that diet with others, and I went on to grow a huge platform online called Livin' La Vida Low Carb, which I used to educate, encourage, and inspire others in their own personal health journeys. I write books, give talks around the world, and speak with some of the most influential and intelligent people making waves in nutrition, fitness, and health. It's been some of the most gratifying work of my entire life, and I'm privileged to be able to do what I do for a living now. Despite my diet turnaround, though, I didn't stop enjoying eating. Hence my skepticism about intermittent fasting. I was intrigued by what Dr. Eads had to say about it, though, and I did my homework. One thing I learned in particular made me sit up and take notice. In 2009, I interviewed Boston College biology professor Dr. Thomas L. Seyfried, who had been researching alternative treatments for cancer prevention and treatment, including using a calorie-restricted ketogenic diet to treat brain cancer and other cancers. One of the more interesting and memorable nuggets from that half-hour interview came at the very end of our conversation when Dr. Seyfried made the bold assertion that an annual 7 to 10 day water fast could be a useful tool for preventing cancer. Wow. But as skeptical as I was about intermittent fasting, a 1 week fast freaked me out even more. Who could actually do that? But by that point, I'd heard enough to convince me to give fasting a try. Needless to say, I had to get my head around IF before I even dared try a multiple day fast, and being the nothing's too hard adventurer that I was, I decided to try it. Boy, oh boy, what was I getting myself into? My first attempt at fasting. Okay, before we get to the good stuff about fasting, I have to be honest about the bad stuff and all I have to say about my first attempt at alternate day intermittent fasting. Fasting for 24 hours every other day is ugh. It lasted exactly 4 days, 19 hours, and 15 minutes, but it felt like an eternity. I did some things wrong that made this attempt much more painful than it should have been, but before I explain that so that you can learn from my mistakes, here's what I learned about myself during my first unpleasant experience of attempting IF in 2006. Number one, I was pretty addicted to caffeine still. That first day of fasting was painful because I had a massive headache for most of the day. By the second day, though, the headache had subsided. Number 2. I hadn't felt truly hungry in a long time. After losing 180 pounds, my philosophy had been to never allow myself to get hungry so I didn't slip back into those old eating habits. Ironically, during my low-fat dieting days, all I did was have hunger pangs. Now, listening to my body is beneficial because I don't have the same food temptations. Number 3. Being ravenously hungry made me overeat. At the end of my second fasting day, my wife Christine and I went to Steak and Ale for their all-you-can-eat prime rib special. They were busy, so the steaks took longer to come to the table than they usually do. I was so hungry that I ate a whole plate of salad in minutes, devoured the first prime rib, waited 20 minutes for my second, and killed that one too. Then my server brought me another one about 30 minutes later, after my food had settled a bit in my stomach, and I started to eat it. But when I got halfway done, whoa, Nelly, I was full. Not just full, but really, really full. As in, it hurt so much that I had to take some tums and lie down for a bit when we got home. I was quite the ravenous beast. Number 4. Eating enough food to fuel my daily workouts really was important. On day 1 of my fast, I tried to keep up the same resistance and speed on my elliptical workout, but it just didn't happen. While I usually have a 13 resistance at 8.5 miles per hour, I had to back off to 7 resistance at 7 miles per hour to keep my workout as long as usual. Of course, I burned fewer calories as well. What was worse was that even on the days I did eat, the very noticeable lack of energy persisted and did not come back until I ended my IF experiment. It took me several weeks to get back to full strength and endurance. Number 5. For me at the time, going without food for 24 hours was not realistic. On the first day, my head was hurting so much from the caffeine withdrawals that I barely noticed how hungry and lightheaded I felt. But on my second fasting day, I felt like I was floating around my office, ready to tip over at any moment. My body was lethargic and I felt disassociated from everything, as if I wasn't in the living world. My coworkers kept asking me if I was okay because I wasn't my normal chipper self. Call me a wimp for not making it through even one whole week on the IF experiment, but it was just not for me. And there are a few reasons why. First, I was still drinking diet sodas during the fast, and that stoked hunger and cravings that I wouldn't have had otherwise. Second, I wasn't getting enough salt during the fast, which led to fatigue and energy drain. Better than those diet sodas would have been bone broth with sea salt, which provides much needed electrolytes and is satiating. And finally, I just didn't have the right mindset. I didn't anticipate just how tough it would be at the beginning, and I wasn't prepared to handle the hunger, both real and imagined. After this attempt at IF crashed and burned in a blaze of glory, I didn't think I'd try it again. But then in 2011, after some gentle prodding from people like Rob Wolf and other intermittent fasting advocates, I decided to give it another go. Success on IF and a growing ambition. During this second attempt, I gave myself 18 to 20 hours between meals, and it was much better for me than going 24 hours between meals. In fact, it was quite easy eating a meal in the morning around 9 a.m. and then another around 2 o'clock p.m. as the totality of my food intake for the day. So I fasted between 2 p.m. one day and 9 a.m. the next day, about 19 hours. I even sometimes mixed it up and pushed my first meal to around 12 p.m. and then the second meal at 5:30 p.m. for a shorter feeding window. I felt very comfortable doing this, and it became very natural to me. I hadn't forgotten about the idea of an extended period of fasting as a way to boost my health, though. When I interviewed Dr. Thomas Seyfried on my podcast in 2009, he was adamant that a one-week fast would be beneficial as an annual cancer prevention strategy. Of course, most people can't, or more realistically won't, do something like this. But what would it be like to actually try it for myself? Once IF started to come more naturally to me in 2011, I decided it might be time to push the total fasting time to an entire week. Would I make it through a longer fast? I didn't know at the time, but today I'm so glad I put aside my fears and gave it the old college try. In addition to my growing ease with IF, two great things gave me the confidence to try an extended fast. First, one of my blog readers who had done 3 1-week fasts over the span of a year on the suggestion of his doctor to help with some prostate issues shared something with me that put things into perspective. Here's what he said. The way you experience yourself physically when you are fasting is practically identical to the way you experience yourself physically when you are eating. The reason this is so important is that when you think you experience hunger while eating normally, that same experience of hunger is present when you are fasting. In other words, the hunger sensations in fasting are the same as while eating normally. You then have to ask yourself, how can you be hungry when you have eaten 3 hours ago, when it is the same hunger sensation when you have not eaten anything at all for a week? What we think is hunger is not really hunger. That impulse to eat cannot be taken seriously. Wow. So if we can learn to view hunger in the right way, then we can be more resistant to the temptations that inevitably befall so many of us during fasting. As my reader so succinctly put it, fasting allows you to reclaim your hunger for what it is, so it no longer dictates what you put in your mouth. Now that's a message I think we can all learn something from. By the way, the series of 1 week fasts my reader completed were tremendously successful in treating those prostate issues he had. This helped convince me that fasting really is a powerful therapy. The second thing that propelled me to do a 1 week fast was that I'd been learning a lot about all the benefits of being in a state of nutritional ketosis, and fasting and ketosis go together perfectly like bacon and eggs. When you eat a low-carb, moderate-protein, high-fat diet, a ketogenic diet, it becomes much easier to fast. The carbohydrate restriction and protein moderation helps to keep your blood sugar and insulin levels under control, and consuming adequate amounts of healthy saturated and monounsaturated fats keeps your hunger at bay. And here's the key to why keto is so great for fasting. Being in ketosis teaches your body to burn fat for fuel rather than sugar. And since that's what your body has to do during fasting, if you're already in ketosis, your body is already using fuel the way it's supposed to. Think of it this way. You have at least 40,000 calories worth of fat on your body right now, but only 2,000 calories worth of sugar. If you're a fat burner, when you start fasting, your body simply continues to use fat as its primary fuel. If you're a sugar burner, though, your body burns through those 2,000 calories of sugar until it's all gone, and then it triggers hunger until it's adapted to using fat. As a sugar burner, you'll feel the effects of hunger during a fast much earlier and more intensely. This is why going keto, covered in detail in my book Keto Clarity, is a great first step for fasting, both intermittent fasting and extended fasting. I wasn't quite in ketosis yet myself when I tried the 1 week fast, but I had been eating low carb for a long time, and I was reassured that my body could handle an extended fast. Extended fasting, take one, a week without food. On the evening of April 10th, 2011, I consciously chose to do one of the most unlikely things I'd ever done in nearly 4 decades of living. I embarked on a 1 week fast on purpose just to see how I would do. So many people asked at the time if I was doing it to lose weight, and the answer was not at all. Any weight loss on a complete extended fast, unlike on a regular IF routine, would not likely stay completely off once food was reintroduced. That's not to say a few stubborn pounds of fat wouldn't find a way to leave my body, and that's never a bad thing. But my primary purpose was to monitor how I felt going without any food for a week. I learned so much more than I could have ever imagined. The physical experience of the fast. The first 3 days were some of the most difficult because my body was screaming at me to eat something. I felt spacey for much of the time, as if everything around me was running in slow motion. But at the same time, my thoughts were clear and I was fully functioning despite having no food. And honestly, I felt good for most of the time through the entire fast. Days 4 and 5 were the best of the 7 as I experienced the big whoosh of renewed energy that I had heard so many people share would happen. On day 6, though, I struggled early on with a strong desire to eat again, and by day 7, when I was at church and took communion, I felt absolutely horrible, like my blood sugar had dropped to a level that zapped me of all my energy. When I checked my blood sugar level and saw a reading in the 50s and could barely stand up around 2 o'clock p.m. on the final day of the fast, I knew it was time to break it. Effects on blood sugar and weight. I didn't measure my blood sugar every single day, but the few times I did, I saw readings in the 60s. Sure, this was below 80, the level I generally saw on my healthy low-carb lifestyle, but that's what happens when you don't eat any food at all. Controlling blood sugar and giving your pancreas a week to rest from producing insulin is an excellent reason for attempting a fast like this. The first few days, I lost about a pound a day, and then on days 4 to 7, I lost several pounds. While I wasn't doing this to lose weight, it certainly produced a sizable drop on the scale, 13 pounds in 1 week. I learned later that the weight loss on a 1 week fast like this is mostly water weight because the fasting process depletes glycogen stores. Exercising. Believe it or not, I decided to keep up my exercise routine during my fasting week, and I did a whole lot better than I thought. I knew not to push it too hard, and I told my wife that if I started to feel dizzy or anything, I would stop. Even still, I played competitive volleyball twice and did a couple of Pilates yoga classes with no problems. Although I was spacey on the volleyball court, I was able to perform quite well running, jumping, and blocking spikes in the front row. The bathroom. Yes, I know it's gross to talk about, but it's a part of the fasting experience. I expected to visit the porcelain goddess frequently in the first couple of days or so, but when I was still seeing massive amounts of stuff coming out late in the week, that was pretty freaky. After all, I hadn't consumed anything in many days, so what was coming out? It reminded me that there's a lot more waste in the body than we even realize, and doing this fast may have helped clean a good bit of that out. Nutritional supplements. I did not stop taking my regular supplements for the duration of the fast. I continued with my multivitamin, vitamin D3, magnesium, probiotics, and other vitamins that had been a part of my healthy low-carb lifestyle for years. Perhaps I could have given this routine a rest for a week too, but I didn't. How I made it through. This was my first attempt at fasting for longer than a day, so I didn't have any idea what to expect beyond what I had heard from others. One of the challenges I faced was how to ward off the symptoms of not eating anything, the lightheadedness and lethargy I'd experienced on my first fast. I was guzzling a lot of water, very important for anyone who's fasting, but I decided I wanted more, so I added in some diet sodas to help get me through. While I no longer drink diet sodas, they were somewhat helpful in getting through the fast. Yes, I know Dr. Fung advises against this, as we'll mention later in this book, and they're probably a big reason why my first attempt at fasting was so tough. It's a journey we all need to take. I also included bouillon cubes to help with electrolyte imbalance. I've since learned that a better, healthier way to get these helpful effects is to drink kombucha and bone broth with sea salt. Other people's reactions. When I started sharing my fasting experience on social media, the reaction I received was probably the most surprising part of the entire fast. It ran all across the spectrum, from encouraging words from people who thought this was a great idea and cheered me on all the way to people telling me I was killing myself and undermining the very low-carb lifestyle principles I promote. Some of the response was as if I'd used the other F word in church. What would I have done differently? I hate to say I'd change anything about my first experience trying a 1 week fast. The experience was what it was, and it was eye-opening. At the time, I planned to eat some coconut oil if the hunger became too much to bear, but it never did, and now I can't help but wonder if the addition of coconut oil or other strategies might have made a difference in the way I felt. Adding in these steps may have stoked some hunger, but maybe not. It got me thinking about how to tweak and improve my fasting attempts in the future. After the fast ended, I decided to write to the man who inspired this one-week fast, Dr. Seyfried himself, whom I had met in person that year at an obesity conference in Baltimore, Maryland. When I told him what I had done, he said he was happy to hear I survived my fasting experience. He said the vitamins I took and other things I added to my fast may have sent mixed signals to the body, making the fast more difficult. Dr. Seyfried noted that a cancer-preventing fast should probably be done using distilled water only and nothing else. He also lamented that I didn't measure the level of ketones, byproducts of the body burning fat, in my blood. I would learn more about that and start testing them 1 year later. He suspected that my blood ketones were elevated, which helped me endure the fast for the week. Dr. Seyfried was so impressed by my experiment that he included it in his textbook on cancer, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease, On the Origin, Management, and Prevention of Cancer. Here's what he wrote. Mr. Jimmy Moore also described his experience with a 7-day, mostly water-only fast in a podcast video. Mr. Moore is a well-known blogger for the health benefits of low-carbohydrate diets. He was able to document the physiological changes he experienced during the fast in non-technical language. Although Mr. Moore followed most of what Herbert Shelton would consider standard practices, Mr. Moore included bouillon cubes in the fast. Chicken and beef bouillon contain some calories and salts, which might prevent glucose from reaching the lowest levels needed to put maximum metabolic pressure on tumor cells. However, Mr. Moore's blood glucose levels did fall within the required therapeutic ranges for tumor management during his fast. Further research is needed to document the influence of bouillon and other low-calorie and low-carbohydrate food items on blood glucose and ketone levels during food fasting. Nevertheless, it is important for cancer patients to recognize from Mr. Moore's podcast that fasting is not harmful. Combining fasting and nutritional ketosis. Fast forward to 2012 when I began my 1-year experiment with nutritional ketosis. By eating a low-carb, moderate-protein, high-fat diet, I was able to switch my body from primarily burning glucose for fuel to burning fat. As part of the experiment, I started keeping track of my blood ketones, as Dr. Seyfried had suggested. I had no intention at all of fasting as part of the ketosis experiment, but I quickly discovered that it just started happening spontaneously and naturally, especially when my blood ketone levels exceeded 1.0 millimolar. I remember that early on in the first few weeks of my experiment, my wife asked me when the last time I ate was. After looking at the clock and then going back through my food logs, I discovered it had been about 28 hours. I had totally forgotten to eat. In light of my history of eating, this was absolutely stunning. Once my body made the switch from burning glucose to burning fat, the idea of eating breakfast, snack, lunch, snack, dinner, snack, midnight snack just seemed silly. Why would I want to eat that often when I wasn't hungry? My body was very clearly telling me it was okay that I didn't think about food that obsessively anymore. We simply aren't meant to be eating as much or as often as we do in modern culture. And getting into ketosis by consuming real whole foods on a diet that is low carb, moderate protein and high fat with adequate calories will allow you to spontaneously fast for 12 to 24 hours. Read my book Keto Clarity to learn more about how going ketogenic can make intermittent fasting a cinch. Amy Berger, Fasting All-Stars. I prefer for my clients to stick to a good, nutrient-dense, low-carb diet and get fat-adapted for a while before experimenting with fasting. I think it's easier and more pleasant to fast when your body isn't still screaming out for carbohydrates. My main point here is that when I got into a state of nutritional ketosis, when I became mostly a fat burner rather than a sugar burner, fasting became completely natural for me. Of course, many of you listening to this aren't eating a ketogenic diet or pursuing nutritional ketosis, and that's fine, although you should be. Dr. Fung has had a lot of success using fasting as a therapeutic approach with many of his patients who aren't in ketosis. But my own experience with fasting has been that it was difficult before I got into ketosis and perfectly natural and easy afterward. That 1 week fast really showed me the power of the ketones in keeping me completely energized and comfortable during a fast. even though I wasn't in ketosis when I started the fast, during the fast, my body was burning fat and producing ketones, and it felt great. That's the bottom line to remember. Once you're accustomed to fasting, it happens very naturally and shouldn't be associated with much hunger or discomfort after the first few times. And the advice in this book will help you get through those first few times, which I admit can be tough. But tough doesn't mean impossible. My first fasting experience was terrible, but now I can do it on a whim and it feels great. The only thing I can tell you to do is try it yourself and watch what happens. It's incredibly freeing to not think about food 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Is it still sounding like another F word to you now? What happens if you do get hungry or don't feel good while intermittent fasting? Hello, McFly, you eat something. This isn't rocket science, people. While it's normal to have some hunger and discomfort for the first couple of days, there's a difference between minor discomfort and the I'm going to literally bite someone's head off if I don't eat something discomfort. If your energy is just gone and not coming back, or you're not feeling like yourself, or you're insanely hungry, don't push through. Fasting shouldn't be physically painful. End it, have something to eat, and try again in a week or so. Of course, as my blog reader shared, true hunger is much different than what we have come to expect. The sad fact is most people don't listen to what their body is telling them. Instead, they eat more out of habit, comfort, and boredom than anything else. This is critical to understand if you're going to attempt to engage in fasting. If you've never done IF before, then a 24-hour period with no food can sound absolutely torturous. Your body is used to getting food at certain times of the day and will send not-so-subtle cues that it is time to eat. I used to think that was true hunger, but it's really not. Instead, it is simply your body's internal clock trying to keep you on a normal, familiar routine of eating. But does that mean we are supposed to succumb to the desire to eat when that feeling hits? I used to think so, but the wisdom of experience has now taught me the answer is an emphatic no. The fact is that our stomach can remain quite satisfied even when everyone else around us is chowing down on food because it's, quote, time to eat, end quote. When I weighed over 400 pounds prior to 2004, I felt like I was hungry virtually all the time, no matter how much food I put in my mouth. Getting my hunger under control and recognizing what true hunger feels like was a huge part of my eventual success and still sustains me all these years later. There are plenty of people like me who can comfortably eat one or two meals a day without a problem thanks to nutritional ketosis, so we can go through periods of fasting quite naturally. But I will tell you now that there will be social challenges associated with fasting. If your friends or family want to gather together for a meal and you're not hungry or engaged in an extended fast, then some people just don't know how to handle it. You don't want to be rude at the gathering, and the host doesn't want to feel they did something wrong. Remember, these occasions aren't really about the food as much as they are about connecting with others. Focus on the connections and let them stuff their face with whatever they want. Most people will hardly notice you aren't eating, and if they do, it's their problem, not yours. Of course, the best thing to do is to plan your fast around celebrations and events where food is important. Don't start a 7-day fast 3 days before a birthday party or wedding. But for everyday spur-of-the-moment get-togethers, try to behave normally and enjoy the company without fixating on the food. Extended fasting, take 2, a 3-week fast. After my success formally testing the ketogenic diet in 2012 and 2013, which led to a deeper understanding of nutritional ketosis, I thought it would be useful to try fasting again. Of course, I didn't need to try IF. I was doing it practically on a daily basis because ketosis made it so easy. So I decided to revisit longer fasting to see if I could go beyond a week. I met Dr. Jason Fung in February 2015, and after learning about the work he was doing with over 1,000 patients using various fasting protocols to improve their health, I was intrigued by the idea of fasting for more than 1 week. Could I make it for 21 days in a row this time around? In September 2015, I set out on a 21-day fast with only water, kombucha, bone broth with sea salt, together totaling well under 200 calories daily. While technically this was not a pure fast, since there was some minimal caloric intake, Dr. Fung advised me that I would get most of the benefits of a water-only fast with this protocol. I shared daily updates during the fast on my Periscope channel. Predictably, my weight came down very quickly, as did my blood sugar levels. They went into the 70s and even upper 60s with no signs of hypoglycemia. I checked my blood ketones as well, and while they started at very low levels, they catapulted to well above 2.5 millimolar by day 4 of the fast. I felt euphoric and surprisingly energetic, unlike the previous time I did a longer fast. My first day of fasting was extremely easy because I was already used to fasting for 24 hours with my ketogenic diet. Day 2 was the most difficult for me. The desire to eat was much more intense than I had expected. But then something incredible happened once I got past the second day. Fasting became surprisingly simple. It was almost too easy to just not eat. The notion that if you don't eat, you'll experience an increasing feeling of hunger the longer it lasts is simply not true. In fact, I dare say that after fasting for a few days, you will actually feel more normal than perhaps you ever have before. And when you don't think so much about what you'll eat, when you'll eat, where you'll eat, and all the other social customs surrounding food, it frees you up to do other things. You'll realize the urge and desire to eat is more mental than physical. So how did my 21-day fasting attempt go? I made it a total of 17 and a half days, only to be sabotaged by something that I really didn't expect. Stress from traveling. My wife and I went on vacation with friends in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, beginning on day 15 of the experiment, and by the evening of day 17, my stomach was growling for 45 minutes straight. Because it was close to bedtime, I decided to wait until the next morning to see if the hunger would dissipate. It did not, and so I broke the fast just a few days short of my original goal. But I listened to my body, and that is always very important when you are fasting. It's not a big deal to end the fast when it becomes obvious the time to stop fasting has come. I'd fasted for nearly 3 times longer than I ever had in my life, so I was pretty stoked. But the fact that I had to stop showed me just how profoundly impactful stress can be, and now I've started taking active measures to reduce stress in my life. Meditation, less time online, yoga classes, and regular massages all help. Because I have severe insulin resistance due to years of poor nutrition, I think stress probably impacts me more than most. If I can figure out this piece of the health puzzle, then maybe a book called Stress Clarity could be in my future. Stay tuned. Rob Wolf, Fasting All-Stars. Fasting is a stress. Whether it's hormetic, beneficial stress, or potentially a detrimental stress, is largely determined by what other life stressors are at play. Predictably, I lost weight on this fast, 19 pounds. While that wasn't its primary purpose, it was a nice little side effect. Most fascinating to me was the fact that 16 pounds had stayed off when I checked 1 month after I ended the fast. That was pretty cool. And because I'm such a nerd when it comes to health markers, I of course ran a series of blood tests before and after my 17 and a half day fast to see what impact the fasting had. Some of these results were predictable, but others took me totally by surprise. Here's what happened to various blood markers prior to and immediately after my fast. Total cholesterol went from 295 to 195. LDL cholesterol went from 216 to 131. HDL cholesterol went from 61 to 50. Triglycerides went from 90 to 68. LDLP went from 2889 to 1664. Small LDLP went from 1446 to 587. Lipoprotein little a went from 441 to 143. Fasting insulin went from 13.9 to 10.0. HSCRP went from 1.6 to 0.94. most of those numbers are related to cardiovascular health, including advanced cholesterol tests. You can learn more about cholesterol numbers in my 2013 book, Cholesterol Clarity. But let me interpret what happened there. Did you see anything that kind of stuck out more than others? Yep, it was the cholesterol. Total cholesterol dropped 100 points in less than 3 weeks of fasting without the need for any cholesterol-lowering medications like statin drugs. As patients, we're often told that drugs are the only way to get our cholesterol down so we won't have a heart attack. And yet here is a totally drug-free method for lowering cholesterol. My HDL-C, known as the good cholesterol, predictably fell from 61 to 50 during the fast. One of the basic materials needed for HDL cholesterol is fat, especially saturated fat. So when you don't consume any food at all, you can expect your HDL to drop. But most of the reduction in the total cholesterol number was in the LDL-C, which dipped from 216 to 131. But this doesn't tell the entire story about the improvements to my heart health. Fasting did something I'd never seen any pharmaceutical drug do before. The advanced lipid panel, known as an NMR lipoprofile test, shows the actual number of LDL particles and the size of those particles. When I began my fast, the total LDL particles, LDLP, was 2889, and the small LDLP, the truly bad LDL, was 1446. After the fast, these numbers dropped to 1664 and 587 respectively, representing a significant improvement. But perhaps the most stunning result of all of these tests was the lipoprotein little a, a risk factor in the development of cardiovascular disease. My initial LP little a of 441 was extremely high, always has been, and it plummeted to 143. That's a powerful indication of the therapeutic effects of fasting. The final two blood tests were for fasting insulin and hsCRP, high sensitivity C-reactive protein, a key inflammation marker. The good news is that these numbers weren't bad before I started and only got better after the fast. There was a nearly 4-point drop in the fasting insulin, and my hsCRP fell almost in half. All in all, the numbers showed that my 3-week fast was a great success, but I wasn't finished yet. Extended fasting takes 3, 4, and 5. Another week, fasting cycles, and a month without food. In mid-October 2015, I did another fast for 1 week to see if I would see similar changes in my key markers. Interestingly, my blood sugar fell once again into the 70s and 80s, and I lost 13.4 pounds. However, that weight didn't stay off this time around. Perhaps I'm one of those people who needs longer fasts to see the results stick. My next fasting experiment took place in December 2015 when I tried cycling the fasting with some non-fasting days to see how that would work for me. I fasted for 6 days, then ate on day 7, fasted another 5 days, then ate on day 13, then fasted another 4 days and ended the fast. It was fun changing things up a bit, but I didn't see the same results doing this as I did with the nearly 3-week consecutive fast. My blood sugar and blood ketone levels never fell to the levels I'd come to expect from an extended fast. That said, I lost 18.2 pounds and had kept off 5 pounds of it when I checked a month later. But I had one more idea for a fast that would be my most controversial one of all. In January 2016, I had the idea to fast for the entire month. Yep, you heard me right. I wanted to fast for 31 days in a row. It was daunting, but I'd been encouraged by the results of my 2 previous extended fasts, so I decided to give it a go. This time around, I thought it would be fun to have a dual X-ray absorptiometry scan, better known as a DEXA scan, run to see what happened to my body fat and muscle mass during this fast. Several of my followers on social media were concerned that I was losing massive amounts of muscle on these fasting experiments. So I was scanned before and after the January 2016 fast. More on those results in a moment. I was going along swimmingly on this fast, seeing fabulous improvements in my blood sugar, which plummeted down into the 70s and 60s again, and blood ketones, which were well over 2.5 millimolar again, and I was feeling fantastic. In fact, on day 11, I decided to test my blood sugar and blood ketones every hour on the hour to see what was going on. The results are in the table that came with the accompanying PDF. Those are some pretty spectacular numbers, and I was feeling incredible throughout the day, despite having not eaten for 11 days in a row at that point. On day 13, I needed to pause the fast and eat because we were driving to Virginia to be with my wife's family. Once again, the stress bug bit me hard, and it took a toll on my ability to fast. Thankfully, I got right back on it after taking one day off and was doing well until 3 days later when we needed to drive home. Once again, the stress caused me to pause the fast for a second time. During travel, hunger, weakness, and a general feeling of blah just hit me like a ton of bricks, and I know not to ignore that feeling. So I again ate on day 16 and began the fast again the next day. I fasted for 6 more days after that, paused one last time on day 22, and then made it the final 9 days of the month. All in all, I fasted 28 of the 31 days in January 2016. Although my blood sugar and blood ketone levels were up and down because I had to pause the fast occasionally, I still lost 22.4 pounds and kept off 14 of it in the month that followed. And what about those DEXA scan results? Now this was fascinating. The scan showed I lost 10 pounds of body fat and another 10 pounds of what it identified as lean tissue, generally interpreted as muscle. All of this supposed muscle loss happened in the trunk area. I actually gained muscle in my arms and legs. When I discussed this result with Dr. Fung, he noted that the DEXA scan can mistake fat loss in organ tissues for muscle loss. In other words, most likely I lost not muscle, but rather fat around my internal organs. A very good thing. So I returned to my low-carb ketogenic way of eating for a couple of weeks and had the DEXA scan run again. What happened to that lean tissue it showed I lost during my fast? Every single pound of that so-called muscle loss was completely gone, and I was back to the level I was at prior to the fast.